work and began a giant pincushion for Doc. It was to be an intricate and provocative design in green, yellow, and blue pins, all cool colors, and its title was Precambrian Memory. Henri's friend Eric, a learned barber who collected the first editions of writers who never had a second edition or a second book, decided to give Doc a rowing machine he had got at the bankruptcy proceedings of a client with a 3-year barber bill. The rowing machine was in fine condition. No one had rowed it much. No one ever uses a rowing machine. The conspiracy grew, and there were endless visits back and forth. Discussion of presents, of liquor, of what time will we start, and nobody must tell Doc. Doc didn't know when he first became aware that something was going on that concerned him. In Lee Chong's, conversation stopped when he entered. At first it seemed to him that people were cold to him. When at least half a dozen people asked him what he was doing on October 27th, he was puzzled, for he had forgotten he had given this date as his birthday. Actually, he had been interested in the horoscope for a spurious birth date, but Mac had never mentioned it again, and so Doc forgot it. One evening he stopped in at the halfway house because they had a draft beer he liked and kept it at the right temperature. He gulped his first glass and then settled down to enjoy his second when he heard a drunk talking to the bartender.
"You going to the party?"
"What party?"
"Well," said the drunk confidentially, "you know Doc, down in Cannery Row."
The bartender looked up the bar and then back.
"Well," said the drunk, "they're giving him a hell of a party on his birthday."
"Who is?"
"Everybody."
Doc mulled this over. He did not know the drunk at all. His reaction to the idea was not simple. He felt a great warmth that they should want to give him a party, and at the same time he quaked inwardly, remembering the last one they had given. Now everything fell into place. Mac's question and the silences when he was about. He thought of it a lot that night, sitting beside his desk. He glanced about, considering what things would have to be locked up. He knew the party was going to cost him plenty. The next day, he began making his own preparations for the party. His best records he carried into the back room, where they could be locked away. He moved every bit of equipment that was breakable back there, too. He knew how it would be. His guests would be hungry, and they wouldn't bring anything to eat. They would run out of liquor early, they always did. A little wearily, he went up to the thrift market, where there was a fine and understanding butcher. They discussed meat for some time. Doc ordered 15 pounds of steaks, 10 pounds of tomatoes, 12 heads of lettuce, 6 loaves of bread, a big jar of peanut butter, and 1 of strawberry jam, 5 gallons of wine, and 4 quarts of a good, substantial, but not distinguished whiskey. He knew he would have trouble at the bank the first of the month. 3 or 4 such parties, he thought, and he would lose the laboratory. Meanwhile, on the road, the planning reached a crescendo. Doc was right. No one thought of food, but there were odd pints and quarts put away all over. The collection of presents was growing, and the guest list, if there had been one, was a little like a census. At the Bear Flag, a constant discussion went on about what to wear. Since they would not be working, the girls did not want to wear the long, beautiful dresses which were their uniforms. They decided to wear street clothes. It wasn't as simple as it sounded. Dora insisted that a skeleton crew remain on duty to take care of the regulars. The girls divided up into shifts, some to stay until they were relieved by others. They had to flip for who would go to the party first. The first ones would see Doc's face when they gave him the beautiful quilt. They had it on a frame in the dining room, and it was nearly finished. Mrs. Malloy had put aside her bedspread for a while. She was crocheting 6 doilies for Doc's beer glasses. The first excitement was gone from the row now, and its place was taken by a deadly, cumulative earnestness. There were 15 tomcats in a cage at the Palace Flophouse, and their yowling made Darling a little nervous at night. Chapter 28. Sooner or later, Frankie was bound to hear about the party, for Frankie drifted about like a small cloud. He was always on the edge of groups. No one noticed him or paid any attention to him. You couldn't tell whether he was listening or not. But Frankie did hear about the party, and he heard about the presents, and a feeling of fullness swelled in him, and a feeling of sick longing. In the window of Jacob's jewelry store was the most beautiful thing in the world. It had been there a long time. It was a black onyx clock with a gold face, but on top of it was the real beauty. On top was a bronze group, St. George killing the dragon. The dragon was on his back with his claws in the air, and in his breast was St. George's spear. The saint was in full armor with the visor raised, and he rode a fat, big-buttocked horse. With his spear, he pinned the dragon to the ground. But the wonderful thing was that he wore a pointed beard, and he looked a little like Doc. Frankie walked to Alvarado Street several times a week to stand in front of the window and look at this beauty. He dreamed about it, too, dreamed of running his fingers over the rich, smooth bronze. He had known about it for months when he heard of the party and the presents. Frankie stood on the sidewalk for an hour before he went inside. "Well," said Mr. Jacobs. He had given Frankie a visual frisk as he came in, and he knew there wasn't 75 cents on him.
"How much is that?"
Frankie asked huskily. "What?"
"That."
"You mean the clock? $50. With the group, $75. Frankie walked out without replying. He went down to the beach and crawled under an overturned rowboat and peeked out at the little waves. The bronze beauty was so strong in his head that it seemed to stand out in front of him, and a frantic, trapped feeling came over him. He had to get the beauty. His eyes were fierce when he thought of it. He stayed under the boat all day, and at night he emerged and went back to Alvarado Street. While people went to the movies and came out and went to the Golden Poppy, he walked up and down the block. And he didn't get tired or sleepy, for the beauty burned in him like fire. At last the people thinned out and gradually disappeared from the streets, and the parked cars drove away, and the town settled to sleep. A policeman looked closely at Frankie. "What are you doing out?" he asked. Frankie took to his heels and fled around the corner and hid behind a barrel in the alley. At 2:30, he crept to the door of Jacob's and tried the knob. It was locked. Frankie went back to the alley and sat behind the barrel and thought. He saw a broken piece of concrete lying beside the barrel, and he picked it up. The policeman reported that he heard the crash and ran to it. Jacob's window was broken. He saw the prisoner walking rapidly away and chased him. He didn't know how the boy could run that far and that fast, carrying 50 pounds of clock and bronze, but the prisoner nearly got away. If he had not blundered into a blind street, he would have got away. The chief called Doc the next day. "Come on down, will you? I want to talk to you." They brought Frankie in, very dirty and frowsy. His eyes were red, but he held his mouth firm, and he even smiled a little welcome when he saw Doc. "What's the matter, Frankie?" Doc asked. "He broke into Jacob's last night," the chief said. "Stole some stuff. We got in touch with his mother. She says it's not her fault because he hangs around your place all the time."
"Frankie, you shouldn't have done it," said Doc. The heavy stone of inevitability was on his heart.
"Can't you parole him to me?" Doc asked. "I don't think the judge'll do it," said the chief. "We've got a mental report. You know what's wrong with him."
"Yes," said Doc, "I know."
"And you know what's likely to happen when he comes into puberty?"
"Yes," said Doc, "I know." And the stone weighed terribly on his heart.
"The doctor thinks we'd better put him away. We couldn't before, but now he's got a felony on him. I think we better."
As Frankie listened, the welcome died in his eyes.
"What did he take?" Doc asked. "A great big clock and a bronze statue."
"I'll pay for it."
"Oh, we got it back. I don't think the judge'll hear of it. It'll just happen again, you know that."
"Yes," said Doc softly, "I know. But maybe he had a reason."
"Frankie," he said, "why did you take it?"
Frankie looked a long time at him.
"I love you," he said.
Doc ran out and got in his car and went collecting in the caves below Point Lobos.
Chapter 29. At 4 o'clock on October 27th, Doc finished bottling the last of a lot of jellyfish. He washed out the formalin jug, cleaned his forceps, powdered and took off his rubber gloves. He went upstairs, fed the rats, and put some of his best records and his microscopes in the back room. Then he locked it. Sometimes an illuminated guest wanted to play with the rattlesnakes by making careful preparations. By foreseeing possibilities, Doc hoped to make this party as non-lethal as possible without making it dull. He put on a pot of coffee, started the Great Fugue on the phonograph, and took a shower. He was very quick about it, for he was dressed in clean clothes and was having his cup of coffee before the music was completed. He looked out through the window at the lot and up at the palace, but no one was moving. Doc didn't know who or how many were coming to his party, but he knew he was watched. He had been conscious of it all day. Not that he had seen anyone, but someone or several people had kept him in sight. So it was to be a surprise party. He might as well be surprised. He would follow his usual routine as though nothing were happening. He crossed to Lee Chong's and bought 2 quarts of beer. There seemed to be a suppressed Oriental excitement at Lee's, so they were coming too. Doc went back to the laboratory and poured out a glass of beer. He drank the first off for thirst and poured a second one to taste. The lot and the street were still deserted. Mac and the boys were in the palace and the door was closed. All afternoon the stove had roared, heating water for baths. Even Darling had been bathed, and she wore a red bow around her neck.
"What time you think we should go over?" Hazel asked.
"I don't think before 8 o'clock," said Mac. "But I don't see nothing against us having a short one to kind of get warmed up."
"How about Doc getting warmed up?" Huey said. "Maybe I ought to just take him a bottle like it was just nothing."
"No," said Mac. "Doc just went over to Lee's for some beer."
"You think he suspects anything?" Jones asked.
"How could he?" asked Mac.
In the corner cage, 2 tomcats started an argument, and the whole cageful commented with growls and arched backs. There were only 21 cats. They had fallen short of their mark.
I wonder how we'll get them cats over there, Hazel began. We can't carry that big cage through the door.
We won't, said Mac. Remember how it was with the frogs? No, we'll just tell Doc about them. He can come over and get them. Mac got up and opened one of Eddie's whining jugs.
We might as well get warmed up, he said.
At 5:30, the old Chinaman flap, flap down the hill past the palace. He crossed the lot, crossed the street, and disappeared between Western Biological and the Hediondo. At the Bear Flag, the girls were getting ready. A kind of anchor watch had been chosen by Straws. The ones who stayed were to be relieved every hour. Dora was splendid. Her hair, freshly dyed orange, was curled and piled on her head. She wore her wedding ring and a big diamond brooch on her breast. Her dress was white silk with a black bamboo pattern. In the bedrooms, the reverse of ordinary procedure was in practice. Those who were staying wore long evening dresses, while those who were going had on short print dresses and looked very pretty. The quilt, finished and backed, was in a big cardboard box in the bar. The bouncer grumbled a little, for it had been decided that he couldn't go to the party. Someone had to look after the house. Contrary to orders, each girl had a pint hidden, and each girl watched for the signal to fortify herself a little for the party. Dora strode magnificently into her office and closed the door. She unlocked the top drawer of the roll-top desk, took out a bottle and a glass, and poured herself a snort. And the bottle clinked softly on the glass. A girl listening outside the door heard the clink and spread the word. Dora would not be able to smell breaths now, and the girls rushed to their rooms and got out their pints. Dusk had come to Cannery Row, the gray time between daylight and streetlight. Phyllis May peeked around the curtain in the front parlor.
"Can you see him?" Doris asked.
"Yeah. He's got the lights on. He's sitting there like he's reading. Jesus, how that guy does read. You'd think he'd ruin his eyes. He's got a glass of beer in his hand."
"Well," said Doris, "we might as well have a little one, I guess."
Phyllis May was still limping a little, but she was as good as new. She could, she said, lick her weight in city councilman.
"Seems kind of funny," she said. "There he is, sitting over there, and he don't know what's going to happen."
"He never comes in here for a trick," Doris said a little sadly.
"Lots of guys don't want to pay," said Phyllis May. "Costs them more, but they figure it different."
"Well, hell. Maybe he likes them."
"Likes who?"
"Them girls that go over there."
"Oh, yeah. Maybe he does.
I've been over there. He never made a pass at me."
"He wouldn't," said Doris. "But that don't mean if you didn't work here, you wouldn't have to fight your way out."
"You mean he don't like our profession?"
"No, I don't mean that at all. He probably figures a girl that's working has got a different attitude."
They had another small snort.
In her office, Dora poured herself one more, swallowed it, and locked the drawer again. She fixed her perfect hair in the wall mirror, inspecting her shining red nails, and went out to the bar. Alfred the bouncer was sulking. It wasn't anything he said, nor was his expression unpleasant, but he was sulking just the same. Dora looked him over coldly.
"I guess you figure you're getting the blocks, don't you?"
"No," said Alfred. "No, it's quite all right."
That quite threw Dora.
"Quite all right, is it? You got a job, mister. Do you want to keep it or not?"
"It's quite all right," Alfred said frostily. "I ain't putting out no beef."
He put his elbows on the bar and studied himself in the mirror. "You just go and enjoy yourself," he said. "I'll take care of everything here.
You don't need to worry.
Dora melted under his pain.
Look, she said, I don't like to have the place without a man. Some lush might get smart and the kids couldn't handle him. But a little later you can come over and you could kind of keep your eye on the place out the window. How'd that be? You could see if anything happened.
Well, said Alfred, I would like to come.
He was mollified by her permission. Later I might drop over for just a minute or two. They was a mean drunk in last night. And I don't know, Dora, I kind of lost my nerve since I bust that guy's back. I just ain't sure of myself no more. I'm going to pull a punch some night and get took.
You need a rest, said Dora. Maybe I'll get Mac to fill in and you can take a couple of weeks off.
She was a wonderful madam, Dora was.
Over at the laboratory, Doc had a little whiskey after his beer. He was feeling a little mellow. It seemed a nice thing to him that they would give him a party. He played the pavane to a dead princess and felt sentimental and a little sad. And because of his feeling, he went on with Daphnis and Chloe. There was a passage in it that reminded him of something else.
The observers in Athens before Marathon reported seeing a great line of dust crossing the plain, and they heard the clash of arms, and they heard the Eleusinian chant. There was part of the music that reminded him of that picture. When it was done, he got another whiskey, and he debated in his mind about the Brandenburg. That would snap him out of the sweet and sickly mood he was getting into. But what was wrong with the sweet and sickly mood? It was rather pleasant.
I can play anything I want, he said aloud. I can play Clair de Lune, or the Maiden with Flaxen Hair. I'm a free man.
He poured a whiskey and drank it, and he compromised with the Moonlight Sonata. He could see the neon light of La Ida blinking on and off, and then the street light in front of the Bear Flag came on. A squadron of huge brown beetles hurled themselves against the light and then fell to the ground and moved their legs and felt around with their antennae. A lady cat strolled lonesomely along the gutter, looking for adventure. She wondered what had happened to all the tomcats who had made life interesting and the nights hideous. Mr. Malloy, on his hands and knees, peered out of the boiler door to see if anyone had gone to the party yet. In the palace, the boys sat restlessly, watching the black hands of the alarm clock.
Chapter 30. The nature of parties has been imperfectly studied. It is, however, generally understood that a party has a pathology, that it is a kind of individual, and that it is likely to be a very perverse individual. And it is also generally understood that a party hardly ever goes the way it is planned or intended. This last, of course, excludes those dismal slave parties, whipped and controlled and dominated, given by ogreish professional hostesses. These are not parties at all, but acts and demonstrations, about as spontaneous as peristalsis and as interesting as its end product. Probably everyone in Cannery Row had projected his imagination to how the party would be, the shouts of greeting, the congratulations, the noise and good feeling. And it didn't start that way at all. Promptly at 8 o'clock, Mac and the boys, combed and clean, picked up their jugs and marched down the chicken walk, over the railroad track, through the lot across the street, and up the steps of Western Biological. Everyone was embarrassed. Doc held the door open, and Mac made a little speech.
Being as how it's your birthday, I and the boys thought we would wish you a happy birthday, and we got 21 cats for you for a present.
He stopped, and they stood
forlornly on the stairs. "Come on in," said Doc. "Why, I'm surprised. I didn't even know you knew it was my birthday." "All tomcats," said Hazel. "We didn't bring 'em down." They sat down formally in the room at the left. There was a long silence. "Well," said Doc, "now you're here, how about a little drink?" Mac said, "We brought a little snort," and he indicated the three jugs Eddie had been accumulating. "There ain't no beer in it," said Eddie. Doc covered his early evening reluctance. "No," he said, "you've got to have a drink with me. It just happens I laid in some whiskey." They were just seated formally, sipping delicately at the whiskey, when Dora and the girls came in. They presented the quilt. Doc laid it over his bed, and it was beautiful. And they accepted a little drink. Mr. and Mrs. Malloy followed with their presents. "Lots of folks don't know what this stuff's going to be worth," said Sam Malloy, as he brought out the Chalmers 1916 piston and connecting rod. "There probably isn't three of these here left in the world." And now people began to arrive in droves. Henri came in with a pincushion 3 by 4 feet. He wanted to give a lecture on his new art form, but by this time the formality was broken. Mr. and Mrs. Gay came in. Lee Chong presented the great string of firecrackers and the china lily bulbs. Someone ate the lily bulbs by 11 o'clock, but the firecrackers lasted longer. A group of comparative strangers came in from La Ida. The stiffness was going out of the party quickly. Dora sat in a kind of throne, her orange hair flaming. She held her whiskey glass daintily with her little finger extended, and she kept an eye on the girls to see that they conducted themselves properly. Doc put dance music on the phonograph, and he went to the kitchen and began to fry the steaks. The first fight was not a bad one. One of the group from La Ida made an immoral proposal to one of Dora's girls. She protested, and Mac and the boys, outraged at this breach of propriety, threw him out quickly and without breaking anything. They felt good then, for they knew they were contributing. Out in the kitchen, Doc was frying steaks in 3 skillets, and he cut up tomatoes and piled up sliced bread. He felt very good. Mac was personally taking care of the phonograph. He had found an album of Benny Goodman's trios. Dancing had started. Indeed, the party was beginning to take on depth and vigor. Eddie went into the office and did a tap dance. Doc had taken a pint with him to the kitchen, and he helped himself from the bottle. He was feeling better and better. Everyone was surprised when he served the meat. Nobody was really hungry, and they cleaned it up instantly. Now the food set the party into a kind of rich, digestive sadness. The whiskey was gone, and Doc brought out the gallons of wine. Dora, sitting enthroned, said, "Doc, play some of that nice music. I get Christ-awful sick of that jukebox over home." Then Doc played Ardo and the Amour from an album of Monteverdi, and the guests sat quietly, and their eyes were inward. Dora breathed beauty. 2 newcomers crept up the stairs and entered quietly. Doc was feeling a golden, pleasant sadness. The guests were silent when the music stopped. Doc brought out a book, and he read in a clear, deep voice. "Even now, if I see in my soul the citron-breasted fair one, still gold-tinted, her face like our night stars, drawing unto her, her body beaten about the flame, wounded by the flaring spear of love,
my first of all by reason of her fresh years, then is my heart buried alive in snow. Even now, if my girl with lotus eyes came to me again, weary with the dear weight of young love, again I would give her to these starved twins of arms, and from her mouth drink down the heavy wine, as a reeling pirate bee in fluttered ease steals up the honey from the nenuphar. Even now, if I saw her lying all wide eyes, and with collyrium the indent of her cheek lengthened to the bright ear, and her pale side so suffering the fever of my distance, then would my love for her be ropes of flowers, and night a black-haired lover on the breasts of day. Even now, my eyes that hurry to see no more are painting, painting faces of my lost girl. O golden rings that tap against cheeks of small magnolia leaves, O whitest so soft parchment, where my poor divorced lips have written excellent stanzas of kisses, and will write no more. Even now, death sends me the flickering of powdery lids over wild eyes and the pity of her slim body all broken up with the weariness of joy. The little red flowers of her breasts to be my comfort moving above scarves, and for my sorrow, wet crimson lips that once I marked as mine. Even now, they chatter her weakness through the two bazaars who was so strong to love me. And small men that buy and sell for silver, being slaves, crinkle the fat about their eyes. And yet no prince of the cities of the sea has taken her, leading to his grim bed. Little lonely one, you clung to me as a garment clings. My girl. Even now, I love long black eyes that caress like silk, ever and ever sad and laughing eyes, whose lids make such sweet shadow when they close, it seems another beautiful look of hers. I love a fresh mouth, ah, a scented mouth, and curving hair, subtle as a smoke, and light fingers, and laughter of green gems. Even now, I remember that you made answer very softly, we being one soul, your hand on my hair, the burning memory rounding your near lips. I have seen the priestesses of Rati make love at moonfall, and then, in a carpeted hall with a bright gold lamp, lie down carelessly anywhere to sleep. Phyllis May was openly weeping when he stopped, and Dora herself dabbed at her eyes. Hazel was so taken by the sound of the words that he had not listened to their meaning, but a little world of sadness had slipped over all of them. Everyone was remembering a lost love, everyone a call. Max said, "Jesus, that's pretty. Reminds me of a dame." And he let it pass. They filled the wine glasses and became quiet. The party was slipping away in sweet sadness. Eddie went out in the office and did a little tap dance and came back and sat down again. The party was about to recline and go to sleep when there was a tramp of feet on the stairs. A great voice shouted,
Where's the girls?
Mac got up almost happily and crossed quickly to the door, and a smile of joy illuminated the faces of Huey and Jones.
What girls you got in mind? Mac asked softly.
Ain't this a whorehouse? Cab driver said there was one down here.
You made a mistake, mister. Mac's voice was gay.
Well, what's them dames in there?
They joined battle then. They were the crew of a San Pedro tuna boat, good, hard, happy, fight-wise men. With the first rush, they burst through to the party. Dora's girls had each one slipped off a shoe and held it by the toe. As the fight raged by, they would clip a man on the head with a spike heel. Dora leaped for the kitchen and came roaring out with a meat grinder. Even Doc was happy. He flailed about with the Chalmers 1916 piston and connecting rod. It was a good fight. Hazel tripped and got kicked in the face twice before he could get to his feet again. The Franklin stove went over with a crash. Driven to a corner, the newcomers defended themselves with heavy books from the bookcases, but gradually they were driven back. The two front windows were broken out. Suddenly, Alfred, who had heard the trouble from across the street, attacked from the rear with his favorite weapon, an indoor ball bat. The fight raged down the steps and into the street and across into the lot. The front door was hanging limply from one hinge again. Doc's shirt was torn off, and his slight, strong shoulder dripped blood from a scratch. The enemy was driven halfway up the lot when the siren sounded. Doc's birthday party had barely time to get inside the laboratory and wedge the broken door closed and turn out the lights before the police car cruised up. The cops didn't find anything, but the party was sitting in the dark, giggling happily and drinking wine. The shift changed at the Bear Flag. The fresh contingent raged in full of hell. And then the party really got going. The cops came back, looked in, clicked their tongues, and joined it. Mac and the boys used the squad car to go to Jimmy Brucia's for more wine, and Jimmy came back with them. You could hear the roar of the party from end to end of Cannery Row. The party had all the best qualities of a riot and a night on the barricades. The crew from the San Pedro tuna boat crept humbly back and joined the party. They were embraced and admired. A woman five blocks away called the police to complain about the noise and couldn't get anyone. The cops reported their own car stolen and found it later on the beach. Doc, sitting cross-legged on the table, smiled and tapped his fingers gently on his knee. Mac and Phyllis May were doing Indian wrestling on the floor, and the cool bay wind blew in through the broken windows. It was then that someone lighted the 25-foot string of firecrackers.
Chapter 31. A well-grown gopher took up residence in a thicket of mallow weeds in the vacant lot on Cannery Row. It was a perfect place. The deep, green, luscious mallows towered up crisp and rich, and as they matured, their little cheeses hung down provocatively. The earth was perfect for a gopher hole, too, black and soft, and yet with a little clay in it so that it didn't crumble and the tunnels didn't cave in. The gopher was fat and sleek, and he had always plenty of food in his cheek pouches. His little ears were clean and well set, and his eyes were as black as old-fashioned pinheads and just about the same size. His digging hands were strong, and the fur on his back was glossy brown, and the fawn-colored fur on his chest was incredibly soft and rich. He had long, curving yellow teeth and a little short tail. Altogether, he was a beautiful gopher, and in the prime of his life. He came to the place overland and found it good. and he began his burrow on a little eminence where he could look out among the mallow weeds and see the trucks go by on Cannery Row. He could watch the feet of Mac and the boys as they crossed the lot to the palace flophouse. As he dug down into the coal-black earth, he found it even more perfect, for there were great rocks under the soil. When he made his great chamber for the storing of food, it was under a rock, so that it could never cave in, no matter how hard it rained. It was a place where he could settle down and raise any number of families, and the burrow could increase in all directions. It was beautiful in the early morning when he first poked his head out of the burrow. The mallows filtered green light down on him, and the first rays of the rising sun shone into his hole and warmed it so that he lay there content and very comfortable. When he had dug his great chamber and his four emergency exits and his waterproof deluge room, the gopher began to store food. He cut down only the perfect mallow stems and trimmed them to the exact length he needed, and he took them down the hole and stacked them neatly in his great chamber and arranged them so they wouldn't ferment or get sour. He had found the perfect place to live. There were no gardens about, so no one would think of setting a trap for him. Cats there were, many of them, but they were so bloated with fish heads and guts from the canneries that they had long ago given up hunting. The soil was sandy enough so that water never stood about or filled a hole for long. The gopher worked and worked until he had his great chamber crammed with food. Then he made little side chambers for the babies who would inhabit them. In a few years there might be thousands of his progeny spreading out from this original hearthstone. But as time went on, the gopher began to be a little impatient, for no female appeared. He sat in the entrance of his hole in the morning and made penetrating squeaks that are inaudible to the human ear, but can be heard deep in the earth by other gophers. And still, no female appeared. Finally, in a sweat of impatience, he went up across the track until he found another gopher hole. He squeaked provocatively in the entrance. He heard a rustling and smelled female. And then, out of the hole came an old battle-torn bull gopher who mauled and bit him so badly that he crept home and lay in his great chamber for 3 days recovering. And he lost 2 toes from 1 front paw from that fight. Again, he waited and squeaked beside his beautiful burrow in the beautiful place, but no female ever came, and after a while he had to move away. He had to move 2 blocks up the hill to a dahlia garden, where they put out traps every night.
Chapter 32. Doc awakened very slowly and clumsily, like a fat man getting out of a swimming pool. His mind broke the surface and fell back several times. There was red lipstick on his beard. He opened one eye, saw the brilliant colors of the quilt, and closed his eye quickly. But after a while he looked again. His eye went past the quilt to the floor, to the broken plate in the corner, to the glasses standing on the table, turned over on the floor, to the spilled wine and the books like heavy fallen butterflies. There were little bits of curled red paper all over the place and the sharp smell of firecrackers. He could see through the kitchen door to the steak plates stacked high and the skillets deep in grease. Hundreds of cigarette butts were stamped out on the floor. And under the firecracker smell was a fine combination of wine and whiskey and perfume. His eye stopped for a moment on a little pile of hairpins in the middle of the floor. He rolled over slowly, and supporting himself on one elbow, he looked out the broken window. Cannery Row was quiet and sunny. The boiler door was open. The door of the palace flophouse was closed. A man slept peacefully among the weeds in the vacant lot. The bear flag was shut up tight.
Doc got up and went into the kitchen and lighted the gas water heater on his way to the toilet. Then he came back and sat on the edge of his bed and worked his toes together while he surveyed the wreckage. From up the hill he could hear the church bells ringing. When the gas heater began rumbling, he went back to the bathroom and took a shower, and he put on blue jeans and a flannel shirt. Lee Chong was closed, but he saw who was at the door and opened it. He went to the refrigerator and brought out a quart of beer without being asked. Doc paid him.
"Good time?"
Lee asked. His brown eyes were a little inflamed in their pouches.
"Good time,"
said Doc, and he went back to the laboratory with his cold beer. He made a peanut butter sandwich to eat with his beer. It was very quiet in the street. No one went by at all. Doc heard music in his head, violas and cellos, he thought, and they played cool, soft, soothing music with nothing much to distinguish it. He ate his sandwich and sipped his beer and listened to the music. When he had finished his beer, Doc went into the kitchen and cleared the dirty dishes out of the sink. He ran hot water in it and poured soap chips under the running water so that the foam stood high and white. Then he moved about, collecting all the glasses that weren't broken. He put them in the soapy hot water. The steak plates were piled high on the stove with their brown juice and their white grease sticking them together. Doc cleared a place on the table for the clean glasses as he washed them. Then he unlocked the door of the back room and brought out one of his albums of Gregorian music, and he put a Paternoster and Agnus Dei on the turntable and started it going. The angelic, disembodied voices filled the laboratory. They were incredibly pure and sweet. Doc worked carefully, washing the glasses so that they would not clash together and spoil the music. The boys' voices carried the melody up and down, simply but with the richness that is in no other singing. When the record had finished, Doc wiped his hands and turned it off. He saw a book lying half under his bed and picked it up, and he sat down on the bed. For a moment he read to himself, but then his lips began to move, and in a moment he read aloud, slowly, pausing at the end of each line. "Even now, I mind the coming and talking of wise men from towers, where they had thought away their youth, and I, listening, found not the salt of the whispers of my girl, murmur of confused colors as we lay near sleep. Little wise words and little witty words, wanton as water, honeyed with eagerness." In the sink, the high white foam cooled and ticked as the bubbles burst. Under the piers, it was very high tide, and the waves splashed on rocks they had not reached in a long time. "Even now, I mind that I loved cypress and roses clear, the great blue mountains and the small gray hills, the sounding of the sea. Upon a day I saw strange eyes and hands like butterflies. For me at morning larks flew from the thyme, and children came to bathe in little streams." Doc closed the book. He could hear the waves beat under the piles, and he could hear the scampering of white rats against the wire. He went into the kitchen and felt the cooling water in the sink. He ran hot water into it. He spoke aloud to the sink and the white rats and to himself. "Even now,
I know that I have savored the hot taste of life, lifting green cups and gold at the great feast. Just for a small and a forgotten time, I have had full in my eyes, from off my girl, the whitest pouring of eternal light.
He wiped his eyes with the back of his hand, and the white rats scampered and scrambled in their cages, and behind the glass the rattlesnakes lay still and stared into space with their dusty, frowning eyes.
We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Cannery Row by John Steinbeck, read by Jerry Farden. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by Claudia Howard. Cannery Row is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA Incorporated and Recorded Books LLC, copyright 1989, all rights reserved. The book, Cannery Row, is available wherever Penguin Classics books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.